Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of who will be left standing in the presidential primaries as Donald Trump continues to dominate the crowded Republican field in spite of alienating a number of constituencies, including American Muslims, who he suggested might have to be registered in a database. David Halpern, a former senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign and White House speechwriter for President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to discuss the comparatively boring race on the Democratic side and which candidate might best deal with the systemic corruption and theft of taxpayer money in Washington, exemplified by the $40 billion a year for-profit college racket in which one company, EDMC, owned by Goldman Sachs, swindled federal taxpayers out of $11 billion. Then we'll speak with Stephen Schwartz, who is an editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, about his new book, The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation, which shows how Margaret Mead's notion, quote, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world, indeed it's the only thing that ever has, can be put into action. We will discuss how the ultimate challenge facing the planet, global warming, can be addressed following the examples of Martin Luther King Jr., Benjamin Franklin, and Mahatma Gandhi, who changed history by implementing the strategies and tactics of the Eight Laws of Change. And joining us now is David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at Republic Report and the Huffington Post, Unrepentant EDMC CEO Will Push Back Against Gainful Employment Rule. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halpern.
Thanks, Ian.
And we often talk about this for-profit college racket, where now there's a company that basically got about $2 billion a year from the taxpayers. They'd settle for $95 million in false claims, even though they've basically taken about $11 billion out of the pockets of the American people for very dubious results. But just to sort of set the context, one of the reasons why we often talk about this is that I think this is one of the issues that indicate how broken and corrupt our government is. And instead of being stewards of taxpayers' money and the Congress giving the American people value for their money, this is an outrageous example of how a politically protected bottom-feeding operation like the payday lenders can basically rip off the American people and just siphon off taxpayers' money and then, you know, fly a bunch of congressmen around in private jets, all on the taxpayers' dime. So that's the sort of context. And my sense is that as Arne Duncan now has had his swan song, just to pull back on the whole education landscape, can you start with the premise that when Arne Duncan came in, just like when Obama came in, Wall Street had tanked and he had to bring back the economy, did Duncan have to, was he faced with the equal disaster on the domestic front as the Iraq War was on the foreign policy front? It looks as if the Bush administration, with their so-called reforms of education, really screwed up American education.
That's a good way of putting it. I mean, basically, under Bush, there was an orgy of waste, fraud, and abuse with our tax money. The goal is good, find money so low-income people can go to college. And the goal was entirely perverted by greedy people who basically used the money and put it in their pockets, provided students with a substandard education that cost students and taxpayers money, left them, the students, buried in debt and without advanced career prospects. And the school that you mentioned, EDMC, is really a good window into the whole thing, a microcosm of all the problems. It was a good school. There are still many fine instructors there. It was bought up by Wall Street, by Goldman Sachs, private equity companies, including Leeds Equity Partners, and they basically looted it. They cut the money on education, on spending. They literally turned classrooms into call centers to recruit more and more students whom they knew couldn't benefit from the program. the cost of going there was twice as much as Harvard for a low-income student. And the students often ended up with nothing, promised that they would be animators and video game designers, and ended up with nothing. And then in the end, when all the investigations, many state and federal law enforcement agencies were looking at this company, they finally caught up with them. The company said, oh, we don't have any money. And so the Justice Department settled for a very, very small amount of money compared with how much gain there was from the wrongdoing here. Crime really has paid in this instance.
And in the broader landscape, the educational landscape, Bush's No Child Left Behind and Common Core, etc., have really basically proven a massive failure, haven't they? That in America, there's something like 187 tests a year for students, and the whole focus has been on testing as opposed to learning. So can you make the analogy with the Iraq War, the devastation that has done, the unraveling of the Middle East, the creation of ISIS today, all of the problems stem from that massive foreign policy blunder? On the domestic side, can you equate in any way what Bush did for education, not just in terms of for-profit colleges, but in just in general, in the whole education portfolio?
I don't know if the K-12 testing stuff, which has largely been continued by under President Obama, has made things worse. It hasn't made anything better. It's resulted in some ways in a transfer of money from old corrupt school systems to the relatives of principals to fancy consultants who get paid by the school systems to set up charter schools and advise them on education policy. But it doesn't look like this whole thing, other than causing a lot of headaches and heartache for little crying students and their parents, has done a whole lot to advance the quality of education, particularly for low-income people. So, I mean, I do think that some of the common thread is greed, that a lot of people got rich off the Iraq War and a lot of people got rich off Bush's so-called reforms of education. But at least in K-12, there was some notion of holding schools accountable. George W. Bush went to the Convention of For-Profit Colleges a few years ago and got paid to speak, and he made, you know, a statement about schools that get federal money should be held accountable, and I think he saw it as an applause line, but it was met with deafening silence because he was speaking to the owners of for-profit colleges whose whole goal is to get the federal money and not be held accountable at all.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He's previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he has an article at Republic Report and the Huffington Post, Unrepentant EDMC CEO Will Push Back Against Gainful Employment Rule. So here we are approaching the Thanksgiving holiday, and I'm not sure that there's a lot to be thankful for. We've just talked about the domestic front and the foreign policy front in terms of the disastrous legacy of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And now we have a president who's getting beaten up by Republican presidential candidates and the press for not being macho enough and going after the self-declared Islamic State. You've got the president of France visiting the White House today, everybody's trying to man up, Putin, Hollande, and I think the good news about Obama is that he's not falling for it, even though you've got these rabid comments coming from the Republican presidential campaigns. Do you think that Obama can hold the line on having a rational response to this without just bombing willy-nilly?
Well, we've done a lot of bombing willy-nilly, of course, or a lot of bombing that's led to civilian casualties under this president. But do I think he can hold the line? Yes, I don't think he will go in. I mean, I'm kind of at a loss right now. ISIS is a terrible, evil organization that is, you know, obviously not only executing Western hostages, but committing just unspeakable abuses towards the people who live in the territories that it holds. But what to do about it? You know, it's like the old joke of the guy who pulls up to the farmhouse in Maine and says, well, how do I get to Johnsonville? And the farmer says, I wouldn't start here. I mean, we're in a terrible place, and you know, if you go back, you know, I think it would be pretty clear we should not have invaded Iraq, because as bad as Saddam was towards his people, it's not as bad as the chaos that was unleashed and the anti-Westernism that was unleashed by the Iraq War and all the suffering of the people there. And I have to say, same thing now with Assad in Syria, the awful dictators, and Mubarak in Egypt, the awful dictators that were running those countries were preferable to the chaos that has been unleashed and the suffering. And the way out of it now, not so clear. But I think President Obama is right that the solution is not another attempt to go house to house and take over an entire Middle Eastern country. We've tried that. It doesn't work. It only makes things worse.
Well, it would seem to me that the real vulnerability of Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State, is that they've proclaimed a caliphate, and everybody wants to get the hell out of the caliphate.
Yep.
That's what this whole emigration is about. And, of course, equally true, people escaping Assad's rule. There's no choices. The choices are hideous in Syria. But, you know, the fact that the Islamic State murdered those two activists from Raqqa who were hiding out and working in Turkey
indicates
they're very sensitive to any reports about what life is really like, and that to me is their greater vulnerability, that, you know, that if this is the caliphate, then it's an absolute nightmare. And the more that's exposed, I think the more vulnerable they are, as opposed to bombing them and making heroes out of them amongst the impressionable youth in the diaspora who are drawn to the cause.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of people will continue to be drawn to, no matter what happens. They may go there, but in the end, it will destroy itself. But it's going to do a lot of harm in the meantime, both on the territory that it holds and to, you know, people in Paris and other places that unfortunately are going to come up against basically a kind of Columbine meets 9/11 mentality about the world.
So if we can address the broader issue that I brought up, and that is in the context of the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday, which is, I think, for me, as somebody that has emigrated to this country, and now, of course, being an emigrant is somewhat endangered with people screaming about Mexicans coming over the border and Iraqi refugees coming in.
Well, you're the right Hugh. I don't think we'll bother you much.
No. I think I got the Anglo-Saxon background and
charming.
Then I came here, I filled out all the forms and did it legally. But nevertheless, it is an outrage to see this immigrant bashing in the land of immigrants, and with the Statue of Liberty, giving me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. So one of the best things about this country is being desecrated by this obscene political discourse. At least that's my opinion.
Yes, I agree with you.
So what do we have to be thankful for as we approach what I consider the great American holiday, which is a real family gathering, and you don't have to exchange presents? Walmart and Target don't own Thanksgiving quite yet. What's your sense about what we have to be thankful for?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, in addition to everything you've said, lobbying in Washington by corporations is destroying our middle-class lives that we, you know, so proudly have built here, and people are in debt and living in their parents' basements. And economically, it is going to be tough for generations here. But what we have is freedom, and we have, when there are efforts to erode freedom after, you know, 9/11 and in other contexts, and people do rise up, and we do. I think we have seen in this country an expansion of protections for individual rights and freedom. And you know, in the last couple years, we went from even Democrats being publicly prejudiced against LGBT people, and now LGBT people have rights. Much broader. They can get married. They can serve openly in the military. That's a good thing. When there is racism, it is tolerated, and the Donald Trump campaign is a sign that it is embraced by some, but it is the minority view. And voting rights have been rolled back, and that's a bad thing, but I think that there will be a pushback against that. So we have some more liberalization, some awareness that freedom matters, that the government can't be acting, you know, as a Gestapo, and that there is a tradition of freedom in this country that we can be thankful for. And, the other thing is, no matter how many bad things happen, you see signs that you cannot keep the human spirit down completely. I watched a video, a lot of people watched a video of a man who whose wife was killed by the ISIS terrorists in Paris, and he said, "You're not going to stop me. You're not going to crush our spirit. I'm going to play with my son every day, and we are stronger than any army." And it's hard to watch that and not cry and not feel that there are people that are just never going to be beaten down, no matter how awful the rhetoric is, no matter how awful the violence is. That there is hope in this world, and there is love. And there are things to keep living for.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, David Halperin, given that Trump and Carson, and particularly Trump, has brought in an incredibly amount of ugliness into the presidential campaign discourse, there's a sense that both he and, of course, Carson is absolutely ignoramus when it comes to foreign policy and will clearly self-destruct. But what is waiting in the wings to pick up the pieces, indeed, if that happens, I think Trump still may come into the convention with more delegates than anybody else. But assuming that they eventually self-destruct, what's waiting in the wings is Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, and yep. In many ways, they scare me more.
I agree. I mean, that they both, in their own ways, are awful. I think Marco Rubio is, I agree with Trump, he's a lightweight, but with bad values and beholden to donors. And Ted Cruz is just a super smarty pants who thinks he can do good impressions, and he can't. And is very, very right wing. I frankly think, I'm always one of the most frightened people at election time that a conservative Republican is going to be elected, and certainly sometimes that happens. But I think in this case, in the end, these candidates are all so weak, and you see the Republican Party in such disarray and saying we got to get Romney back, that I think that Hillary Clinton will be the president, like her or not. But it is the idea that any of the top five contenders, including Jeb Bush for the Republican nomination, now might be president, does seem a pretty depressing and almost horrifying thought, given the positions they're taking and the lack of competence that they've demonstrated while running for president.
But just in closing, it does seem, though, that the Republicans are still going to maintain their control of the House, and they control more of the state houses and governorships, much more than the Democrats do.
Yes, and I don't frankly think even the Senate, U.S. Senate, will go back to the Democrats. So I think we will be living in a continued world of paralysis where the strongest force will be special interests, lobbyists for corporations, and it's going to be a tough road ahead, and I hope people will continue to engage in advocacy and public policy work to try to make things better, but it's not going to be that much fun. There are a lot of other careers that would probably be more enjoyable.
Well, I nevertheless wish you a happy Thanksgiving, David Halperin, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. Happy holidays to you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at ProPublica Report. He's previously the founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant to national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at Republic Report in the Huffington Post, Unrepentant EDMC CEO Will Push Back Against Gainful Employment Rule. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the 8 laws of change, how to be an agent of personal and social transformation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stefan Schwartz, who is a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. And his latest book is The 8 Laws of Change: How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stefan Schwartz.
Hi, Ian. How you doing?
Very well, thanks. And your book is really an important gift for the beleaguered political activists in this country who feel in many ways that they're up against an insurmountable wall of corporate power and entrenched interests, and that, you know, we know that we have one of the lowest voting turnouts of all the advanced democracies, which may indicate that apathy is a result of a sense of resignation that nothing can change, that the system is rigged, and that all you can do is sort of stare at your navel and get stoned. So I think you've done us all a favor here by saying, no, there are, you'd be surprised how one small step can start a massive stampede.
Well, that is exactly. I mean, you've encapsulated it very well. That was precisely why I wrote this book, because I kept finding amongst the social activist, social progressive friends this sense of despair and apathy. And when I began to do research in this area, I've been doing this for about 16 years now, I realized that myth is carefully cultivated because it absolutely keeps people from voting. It makes them feel like they can't make a difference, when in fact, as the data shows, and this is entirely a book based on data, the data shows that small groups of individuals who can work out several basic principles can, in fact, change the course of history, and we know that because we have the historic record of how they've done it. And there is now a large body of neuroscience research that explains to us why it works.
So let's start with some of the big examples, like Martin Luther King Jr., Benjamin Franklin, Mother Teresa, and Mahatma Gandhi. Most people assume that they, through some sort of supernatural power, were able to change the zeitgeist, but it's not quite that way, is it?
No, I mean, let's start with Franklin, since that's the oldest one you cite. You know, very few people know that as you and I are having this conversation today, about 3,500 young people, mostly people of low income and many people of color, are getting an advanced education financed by Benjamin Franklin, because in 1789, Franklin invented micro-lending and wrote it into his will. It's one of my favorite stories because I cannot conceive of any present politician thinking like this. I mean, imagine, here we have Franklin. He's now a man in his 80s. He knows that he's dying. He's got all kinds of health problems. And he's sitting out under the mulberry tree at his house in Philadelphia thinking about how can I continue to create forces which will support what he called virtuous citizens, by which he meant a person who was technologically sophisticated, ethically grounded, interested in the betterment and increased wellness of his community. And he literally invents micro-lending. He writes a codicil to his will in which he gives money to both Philadelphia and to Boston, the two major cities of his life. And he says part of this money is to be used to create baths and hospitals and sanitation, because when cities make wellness a first priority, then everybody prospers and feels better and more optimistic. And so I want part of my money to do this. And he says the other part of the money is to be loaned in small amounts to young married artificers, young craftsmen, who are to help them get started, and that it's going to run for 100 years. And then at the end of the first 100 years, I appoint a committee to adjust my bequests, and then it's to run for another 100 years. And in fact, he died in 1790, and that system that he set up ran to 1990. It produced some of the major parks in both cities. It funds the education of young people to this day. And it is an example of what a person holding a common intention for the general wellness of their community can accomplish by being creative and identifying a leverage point where relatively small amounts of money can make a huge difference. And what Franklin did, other people could do. It's they lack the vision, I think, and the belief that they can make a difference. And so when I wrote this book, what I wanted to do was to do the book in three parts. The first part is how to do it. The second part is stories like the story of Franklin or the story of Gandhi, people who've actually done it. And then the third part is all the neuroscience and social science that explains why it works. Because I think you probably agree, the 2016 election is going to set the course for this country for a generation, because whoever gets elected president is going to get 3 and possibly 4 Supreme Court appointments, as well as making critical policy as climate change really begins to bite. So it makes a huge difference that people get out and vote, and that they recognize that if they can hold common intention together, that they really can make a difference.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who is a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. And his latest book is The 8 Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. But in terms of lesser known people, you're arguing in your book that successful and enduring change is often brought about by something so subtle it is often not taken seriously, and that is small individual choices based on integrity and shared intentions. So elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, okay, let me say this quite explicitly. If all the people that are listening to your show, and I know that's a large number of people all over the country, will make the following pledge: we can change the course of the 2016 election to be more positive, compassionate, and life-affirming. Here's all you have to do. Be aware all day long that you are making thousands of choices. Believe it or not, studies show that most people don't recognize when they're exercising decision points. When you go into the supermarket, you know, what kind of toilet paper do you buy? What kind of toothpaste do you buy? What kind of breakfast cereal do you buy? You need to be aware that you're making a choice, and that by your small financial transaction, you are supporting corporations that either support compassion and life-affirming choices or that don't. And so you get to make a choice, and you make these choices thousands of times a day. So the first thing is, be aware you're making a choice. And the second thing is, of the options that are available to you, and none of them may be great, but of the options that are available to you, one of them inevitably will be more compassionate and life-affirming than the others. And you pledge that you will make the choice that is the most compassionate and life-affirming option of the choices that you have. And if you will consistently do that and tell other people that you are doing it and invite them to join you in doing it, you can just do the math. I mean, you just start with 1,000 people. If 1,000 people were to do this, and they each went to 10 friends and said, I am making only compassionate, life-affirming choices of the options available to me as I understand it, and I invite you to do the same. And those 10 people in turn went out to 10 people. By the time we got to November 2016, people would be voting quite differently because there would be a compassionate, life-affirming intention that had entered into the culture. And we can see examples of this actually playing out. I'll give you one very quickly. Look at the difference between gay and LGBT. If you look at the, for instance, like Google word counts, you'll discover that about a year ago, maybe 15 months, suddenly there was a shift. And when people would normally have used the word gay, they used the word LGBT, which is not only a change in term, but it's also a change in concept because it's much more comprehensive and it deals with gender identity in a much broader way than just gay. Now, nobody went on television and said, we're passing a law, you have to say LGBT. No prominent figures went out and gave speeches that we should do this. What happened was thousands and thousands of people, when they came to a point in their conversation or their writing where they would have said gay, instead said LGBT. And that little shift carried out not by law, not by fiat, not by proclamation, but by the choices made by ordinary people in the course of their day, that changed the entire culture of the country. I mean, I could have cited smoking as another example, or marriage equality as a third example, or marijuana legalization as a fourth example. There is no force, no power on earth as powerful as the concerted, intentioned commitment of ordinary people.
Well, indeed, as you point out in your new book, Stephen Schwartz, The 8 Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation, the anthropologist Margaret Mead famously said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And some of the instances you point about socially progressive evolutions took place in American society. The abolition of slavery, the implementation of public education, penal reform, women's suffrage, civil rights, nuclear disarmament, and environmental protection were all, in many ways, a lot of this was, my understanding is that this was brought about by, initially the spark, if you will, the nucleus of the movement came from small groups of Quakers, which then sort of remind me of what you told us about one of the founding fathers, Ben Franklin, that this is almost in the DNA of the American Revolution. But let me just add something that I want to get your reaction to, and that is that what I don't understand in terms of our politics is why it is that liberals and progressives in America are so much on the defensive, whereas conservatives, who, by the way, mostly aren't true conservatives, they're not about conserving, particularly when it comes to things like global warming, they're more accurately described as reactionaries. Maybe they bullied them into submission. But my sense is that liberals and progressives, over the arc of history, have nothing to be defensive about because they are the ones that did all of the heavy lifting in terms of all the issues that we just enumerated. Women's rights, civil rights, human rights, nuclear disarmament, saving the economy both in 1929 and in recently in 2008. It was the liberals and progressives who stepped up and did the heavy lifting. All the conservatives and reactionaries ever said was just say no. No to human rights, no to civil rights, no to women's suffrage, and so forth. So I think psychologically there has to be a way to turn this around. And for people that have done the heavy lifting on the progressive side to be proud of their record of achievement as opposed to be defensive.
Yes, I completely agree with you. The the reality of how our culture was formed, how the middle class was created, how the United States led the world for the last, since the post-World War II period, in creating prosperity. Most of this was done as a result, going back to Franklin Roosevelt, of creating social programs that place wellness as their first priority, as opposed to profit. And I think more than that, climate change is going to drive us to make that change from profit only to wellness first. And if you look at the data, again, you know, I really don't care very much about political ideologies or philosophies. What I care about is social policies and social outcomes. If you do this, what happens? And if you look at both across the United States and between the United States and other countries, let's just start with the states to begin with. You could look, for instance, at what has happened in California as opposed to what has happened in Kansas. Or you could look at what's happened in Wisconsin compared to what's happening in Minnesota, a sort of first cousin state. And in both of those, California and Minnesota, states which made wellness their first priority in all kinds of ways are prospering, and states which chose conservative austerity, trickle-down economics, and the fantasy small government philosophy, which is never really about small government, they are all in desperate trouble. I mean, you just look at Kansas, for instance, and the deficits that Sam Brownback has created, or the disaster for middle-class people that Scott Walker created in Wisconsin. The key here is that wellness-oriented social policies are, A, more successful, B, cheaper, C, more efficient, D, more effective, and E, longer lasting. I mean, there's just no question about this. You can look at the data. You can look at the comparison, for instance, between red value states and, you could take life expectancy. You could take child mortality. You could take maternal mortality. You could take divorce. You could take obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease. In every one of those social outcome categories, red value policies produce notably inferior social outcomes compared to blue value social policies. It's very obvious that if you make wellness your first priority, whatever it is you're doing, if it increases wellness, you will be more successful, you will actually make more money, it will be cheaper, all of those things. I think the great challenge in the United States is that large numbers of people, out of fear, by being manipulated, and fear is the key to this, by the way, actively vote against their own self-interests. And that is one of the tasks of the compassionate, socially progressive individual, is to make the point that you are working against your own self-interest, and that you can overcome fear, because part of it has to just do with neuroscience. About 27% of the population have overactive right amygdalas, and the amygdala is a little gland in your brain that deals with fight or flight. And when it kicks in, rational thought stops. And it correlates very strongly with conservative religiosity and conservative politics. And so what you can derive from that is that people are easily manipulated when fear comes into play. And we need to make it clear to people, and those of us who are socially progressive need to explain in clear ways to people at the local level that the choices that they make will either produce wellness, which will result in greater prosperity, greater health, greater social stability, or we can operate out of fear and hate, and that will produce social destruction. And the choice is really ours. I mean, you see that a democracy operates on individual choice. And if you don't make a choice, that's making a choice. So if you don't vote, you're voting. The absence of voting is a form of voting. And we need to get enough people out voting who make compassionate and life-affirming choices, whatever those options are, that we can shift the arc of the narrative of history. And more importantly, we know how many people it's going to take. It takes, research shows that when 10% of any group of people, whether it's a small group or a nation, make a change in consciousness toward the compassionate and life-affirming option, that the whole cohort tips. So that was going to require about 24 million people have got to make a shift. We can do this. As I said when we began, if the people who are listening to your radio program would just make that one pledge about making compassionate, life-affirming choices and telling others what they're doing and inviting them to join, we can make a change in the outcome of the 2016 election. It is a mathematical certainty.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and continue the conversation with our guest today, Stephen Schwartz. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication schwartzreport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His latest book just out is The 8 Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. So how much, though, do you think, I mean, obviously, as a species, and you mentioned Ben Franklin, the example of a politician who was a visionary thinking hundreds of years ahead, and our politicians barely think, and our business leaders only think of the next quarter at the most. So we're obviously sort of hamstrung in that regard. But in terms of meeting the challenges, and there's no greater challenge than global warming and climate change, is it essentially a case of we know that if we don't wake up soon, it's going to be too late. What does it take? In other words, you know, all you have to do is turn on the television and see the weather that's going on in the world and recognize that this is all unprecedented. The evidence is overwhelming and mounting every day, and yet there is this inertia that is really frightening.
Well, I think, again, it's fear. Now, I think that what the data is telling us, doesn't matter what I think, the data is telling us, we, as you point out very correctly, we are now at a place where climate change, by any calculation that anybody can make, is going to severely impact us. I mean, there studies show, for instance, that 400 American cities that lie along coastal areas are going to be devastated by climate change. And it really doesn't matter, in a certain way, what we do, because it's already, there's so much momentum in the system that this is going to happen. Sea rise is going to happen. just based on what's already occurred. And as a result of that, cities like Miami or Charleston or Norfolk or New York, Philadelphia, Washington, San Francisco, Los Angeles, they're all going to be devastated as a result of this. So we need to begin to prepare for this. And the fact that we have one major party, uniquely, by the way, in the industrialized world or the developed world, we uniquely have one party which has taken the position that climate change doesn't exist, and that there, or if it exists, that it has nothing to do with human activity. And we need to change that, and we need to change it at the local level. You need to start with your local community. Go into your city council and ask them, what are you doing about climate change? What kind of plans are being made? We need individually to begin to put ourselves forward, asking questions, challenging decisions, because that is a leverage point that local communities can begin to operate with. I mean, up here where I live in the Pacific Northwest, we began a movement that now has 37 communities involved with it, and the Thriving Community Movement throughout Cascadia. And one of the things that we're focusing on is, what are we going to do about climate change? Because this is going to be an incredibly disruptive force in the world. We're going to have huge migrations as a result of people leaving, either because there's either too much water or not enough water, or because of the social instability that the lack or overabundance of water is going to create. And you can get a sense of what this is going to look like by looking at the Muslim migrations which are pouring into Europe now as a result of the, basically, I think, as a result of the neocon decisions to destabilize Iraq, the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld people. I mean, you can see in those migrations that are pouring into Europe how much stress this is creating. So it is in everybody's immediate interest to begin to think about, how are we going to deal with this? And it is possible at the local level to begin to make changes which will assist in responding to this. And our failure to do this only makes the ultimate outcome all the bleaker. So we need to start now making these kinds of decisions.
So is there something, though, about humankind that we only respond when, you know, we start to feel the pain? I mean, that's the conundrum we're in, isn't it? That we're at a point now where we're not, you know, a lot of, if you talk about the 2016 elections and what's important in terms of voting, I mean, it couldn't be more important if you're talking about this issue, climate change, when, you know, one of the likely front runners, assuming that Trump and Carson eventually implode, would be Marco Rubio, who is a climate change denier. So that would be pretty stark if he became a presidential candidate. But the extent to which this is the moment now of decision, and, you know, if you wait for the evidence to be so painful that it's inescapable that climate change is happening, it may be too late.
What is too late? I mean, if by too late you mean we're going to stop all change, that isn't going to happen. We are already so far down the line in this trend that we are going to face massive social disruption. That's just a reality. I mean, you can look at any number of studies that will show you that. You can look at what's happening to cities like Miami or Norfolk and or North Carolina, along the North Carolina coast, and you can already see cities which are truly being impacted by this. And, I mean, if you look, for instance, let's just take Norfolk, about a third of the city is doomed. And that's going to be true almost regardless of what we do. The question is, how much worse is it going to be, and what are we going to do to begin remediation to deal with this? And the answer, I think, is that people have got to get past just the coverage of these events that goes on in corporate media. You know, we have five corporations that own essentially 90% of what you listen to or see or read. I mean, it's astonishing. Almost nothing is said about this, but the corporate media is essentially five large corporations. It's only small operations like Pacifica and the programs such as yours that are giving people information that is not corporate approved, as it were. So it's going to take work to get information, but the good part is that as a result of the internet, there are lots of sources now to get information about these subjects. And the thing that one has to do is to look at your own community and begin to talk to people within your community. You don't have to think larger than that. Just what are you going to do in your community? If you live along a coastline, you need to get in and ask your city council or your county commissioners, what are we doing about this? What's going to happen? Because it's those kinds of small individual actions at these leverage points that is going to figure out how we're going to respond and how we're going to deal with it. California, under Jerry Brown, has become a leader in this because he recognizes, I mean, I think you could argue he's the best, most experienced governor in the United States, and recognizes that we are going to be dealing with this. It's not, are we going to deal with it? It's how are we going to deal with it? It's not, is this going to happen, but how much pain are we going to put ourselves through until we wake up? And so I think, I'll just say again, it has to do with individual choices. Individuals, there is no force more powerful than the collective intention of a large mass of people. And it can be done. And in the book, what I tried to spell out was how to do it exactly. Not in terms of specific details of thing, but following eight basic principles. You know, and they're not what you would expect. I mean, they're certainly, when I began this research 16 years ago, certainly was not what I expected. I mean, for instance, the first principle, the first law is the individuals individually and the group collectively must share a common intention. Well, if you've ever worked on a committee, you know how hard it is to get a common intention. It takes time. It takes commitment. The second law is the individuals and the group may have goals, but they may not have cherished outcomes. Now, that was Franklin illustrated that. He set in motion a process for creating a technologically sophisticated middle class. His image of America was that it was a middle class country, technologically sophisticated, family-centered, mutually supportive, optimistic in its worldview. But how exactly that was going to happen, he did not spell out. He only said, this is my goal, to create virtuous citizens. And he allowed time and circumstance to dictate, if you have that intention, then you know which choices to make. Law number three, the individuals in the group must accept that their goal may not be reached in their lifetimes and be okay with this. I mean, I got this from the abolitionists who would write in their diaries or in their correspondence, you know, I don't know that slavery will end in my lifetime, but I'm committed to do what I can to make this horrible evil stop. So you have to be willing to work at it, even though you may not get immediate gratification. Law number four, the individuals in the group must accept that they may not get either credit or acknowledgement for what they've done and be okay with this. And you can see this in the Quakers, this little tiny group of people who have been so responsible for social change in the United States, that most of it is done anonymously. We don't know who they are. I mean, who knows how many, who knows the names of the Quakers who, for instance, began Greenpeace, which was begun by a couple of Quaker couples and a handful of media people up in Vancouver, Canada. Law number five, each person in the group, regardless of gender, religion, race, or culture, must enjoy fundamental equality, even as the various roles in the hierarchy of the effort are respected. And then you can look at all the social movements you know about and the arguments about, is the person who is in a higher ranking position a superior person? And you have to recognize, no, they are not, that we need to create hierarchies in order to get things done, but that we are fundamentally equal. And it's those kinds of recognitions, following those kinds of principles, that are what produce success. When I went through all of the social transformation movements that I looked at, and hundreds of them, what I saw was that they all found these eight laws and worked them out. And a group of sociologists and other researchers working discovered that social transformation that is nonviolent is 75% of the time successful, whereas violent change is only successful 25% of the time.
Well, quickly, go to the last couple of changes, if you will. We're going to wrap it up here.
Okay. Law number six, the individuals in the group must forswear violence in word, act, and thought. Well, that's pretty straightforward. Law number seven, this is one that you will recognize immediately. You've done a lot of coverage of people like this. The individuals in the group and the group itself must make their private selves consistent with their public postures. I mean, you think of all the religious figures, all the political figures who put themselves forward as family value people, who piously talk about how people should behave and then in their private lives behave exactly opposite to that. Law number seven, or law number eight, the individuals in the group and the group collectively must always act from the beingness of life-affirming integrity. And what I mean by that, I can illustrate with a story about Gandhi. A young reporter came up to Gandhi right before he was assassinated and said to him, "How did you force the British to leave India? They'd been here for almost 300 years. They were this huge power. How did you force them to leave India? You had no army, you had no money, you had no official position, and yet you forced them to leave." And Gandhi's response, I think, illustrates what I mean by beingness. He said, "It isn't what we did that mattered, although that mattered, and it isn't what we said that mattered, although that mattered. It was the nature of our character that led the British to choose to leave India." And notice the difference between force and choose. The British left India because the collective consciousness of India and the people of India changed.
Well, Stephen Short, we've run out of time, but I very much appreciate your joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories of Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His latest book just out is The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.